Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 399, titled The Serpent's Diaries, being recorded on February 16th of the year 2003. The title is a contraction of the title of two books put out by National Vanguard Books. Both of them are at least ostensibly novels, but in fact, William Pierce, the head of the National Alliance, whose publishing arm, the National Vanguard, publishes these books, has been quite candid about putting out novels that are intended as teaching tools for his Nazi faithful. And what I'm doing for the title of this is contracting Serpent's Walk with the Turner Diaries, and we're going to talk about both books and the projections that appear to be taking place of the dogma that is contained between the lines in both books. Before I continue with the discussion, let me remind you that within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed article-length annotated description of For the Record 399 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. That is equipped with real audio, too, by the way. Also, sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory, and older programs are available for download only on a longer URL linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website. Now, we're going to approach the subject material of this broadcast through a portal which will be familiar to veteran listeners but will appear perhaps utterly absurd to others. We're going to be continuing with our discussion of the concept of the virtual state, a state without formal geographical borders as such, and I have been specifically talking about the Underground Reich, quite literally a Third Reich gone underground at the end of World War II and perpetuated through enormous political and economic power, and I've been talking about its presence in opposite sides of ethnic, racial, and ideological divides, and we're going to be approaching the question of war in Iraq with terrorism and in connection with things that will appear utterly strange to many people, hence the references to descriptions and to other broadcasts. We're going to be approaching the question of war in Iraq and geopolitics through the Oklahoma City bombing and recall in a couple of different programs, first of all, a broadcast that dealt with what an LA Weekly article called the Terrorist Motel. And this deals with a motel outside of Oklahoma City that was, according to witnesses, at various times a partial base of operations for Timothy McVeigh and other unnamed alleged Middle Eastern accomplices, and also a motel that was apparently the rendezvous place for Zaharias Moussaoui and Mohammed Atta and some of the conspirators involved in September 11th. Recall in For the Record 386, we also dealt with a link, an evidentiary tributary running between the first World Trade Center attack in 1993 and the Oklahoma City bombing, and through that to the milieu of September 11th, specifically a fellow named Edwin Angeles, who alleged that he saw Terry Nichols at a meeting with Ramzi Youssef in the Philippines. Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center attack and connected to Al-Qaeda. Edwin Angeles was not admitted as a defense witness in the trial of Timothy McVeigh. Edwin Angeles also was described in an article from the Manila Times as the co-founder of Abu Sayyaf, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in the Philippines. What we're going to be looking at is the Oklahoma City bombing and links that run from that crime to the Underground Reich present in various milieu, plural, ranging from the Bush administration to Saddam Hussein to other Middle Eastern peoples and also peoples of what the Nazi geopoliticians called the Earth Island. And this is also in the context of the proxy war that I've spoken about in a number of recent broadcasts. On Wednesday, February 12th, Yahoo's website carried an AP story that was titled Memos, FBI Linked Oklahoma City Bomber McVeigh to White Supremacist Group. And again, this is an AP story, and it reads in part, After the Oklahoma City bombing, FBI investigators gathered evidence linking Timothy McVeigh to white supremacists who had threatened to attack government buildings, investigative memos show. Several of the documents were not provided to the Oklahoma City bomber's defense before he was convicted. And the FBI agent in charge of the investigation says he never received one teletype from his own headquarters that raised the possibility McVeigh was aided by other accomplices. Now, this will not come as a great surprise to people that have researched the Oklahoma City bombing. It was quite apparent from the get-go that McVeigh was aided by others. Elements of the militia movement and that milieu began generating information shortly after the attacks that this was a government conspiracy. I don't believe that to be the case. However, the milieu involved in the Oklahoma City bombing is an underground Reich milieu that transcends ethnic and ideological divides to a certain extent. And what we're going to do is to review a person who was the alleged mastermind of the Oklahoma City bombing, and this by way of entering a portal. Now, bear in mind that there are links through what might be called a Yaqui'ite or a third-position fascist milieu between Islamic extremists, secular Arabo-fascists such as Saddam Hussein's regime, and white supremacists and Nazis in the United States and Europe. And we're going to talk about some of their common goals in just a minute. We're going to review a section from the book The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee. This was published in 1997 in hardcover by Little Brown and Company. And we're going to be talking about a Tulsa-based white supremacist named Dennis Mahone, a guy named Andreas Strassmeyer, who according to an ATF informant named Carol Howe, was the mastermind for the Oklahoma City bombing, and basically Timothy McVeigh, according to Howe, was his protege. Bear in mind that McVeigh apparently reacted with deep revulsion to the U.S. involvement in the Persian Gulf War in 91, and then was further outraged by the Waco siege in 1993. As we've seen in past discussions, including For the Record 174, the Justice Department people who were on the scene at Waco and controlling things, even though Bill Clinton was president, were people who were not only appointed by the elder George Bush, but people who had links to the interagency governmental networks that were controlled by the elder George Bush and that were used to effect not only the Iran-Contra machinations, but also the American end of the arming of Iraq in the first place. And we're going to talk more about the Reagan administrations and the first Bush administration, but reviewing now who was in charge of Timothy McVeigh, according to Carol Howe, who passed a polygraph examination, by the way, and then became the focal point of government attacks herself. Talking about Andreas Strassmeyer and his background, Strassmeyer's links to McVeigh and America's violent racialist underground are all the more curious given Andreas's high-powered family background in Germany. His father was an early member of the Nazi Party. Years later, his father, Gunter Strassmeyer, served as Helmut Kohl's de facto chief of staff. A top Christian Democratic official in Berlin, Gunter was also a close friend and advisor to the chancellor. When the Berlin Wall opened in November of 1989, they celebrated together in the streets. In 1991, Andreas Strassmeyer's American attorney, the ubiquitous Kirk Lyons, visited his client's parents at their plush residence in Berlin. By the way, Kirk Lyons is a top Aryan Nations attorney associated with the neo-Confederate movement, among other things, and also a person who successfully defended a group of white supremacist defendants who were accused of trying to blow up the Oklahoma City bombing in 1988. I would note that both the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995 and the attack on the World Trade Center on September 11th of 2001 had antecedents. There was a relatively unsuccessful attack, or at least a plot, in the years preceding those events. Bear in mind, too, that although it's not mentioned here, Gunter Strassmeyer was the architect of German reunification, and that was successfully realized when the elder George Bush was president of the United States. Beginning again with this passage here about Andreas and Kirk Lyons and Gunter Strassmeyer, in 1991, Andreas Strassmeyer's American attorney, the ubiquitous Kirk Lyons visited his client's parents at their plush residence in Berlin. Lyons assured Gunter Strassmeyer that his son was doing well in the United States. It was Lyons who helped arrange for Andreas to come to America in the first place. Lyons also introduced his young German friend to the folks at Elohim City. So note here the relationship between a prominent Aryan Nations attorney in the United States, someone affiliated with the neo-Confederate movement now, and Helmut Kohl's chief of staff and the son of a founding member of the Nazi Party under Hitler, and the relationship between these so-called street Nazis in the United States, or operational-level white supremacists, one might call them, and some of the highest levels of the German political establishment. And bear in mind it was Lyons who brought Andreas Strassmeyer to the U.S. in the first place. Continuing with Martin A. Lee's The Beast Reawakens. On April 18, 1995, the day before the Oklahoma City attack, Kirk Lyons' North Carolina law office received a 15-minute phone call from Timothy McVeigh, who again was using an alias. McVeigh had already cased the federal building in Oklahoma City. The militia movement went on high alert on the second anniversary of the Waco raid, and that's when McVeigh chose to attack, according to a federal indictment, which left open the possibility of a wider conspiracy involving, quote, others unknown, unquote. ATF informant Howe has gone so far as to peg Andreas Strassmeyer as the prime instigator of the bombing. She alleges that Strassmeyer exerted an extraordinary influence over McVeigh. Strassmeyer, who has since moved back to his parents' house in Berlin, denies any involvement in the Oklahoma City massacre. I would note that there are other evidentiary tributaries connecting the McVeigh milieu to elements of the white supremacist movement. I've talked about those in various programs, for the record, 88, 92, and 97 among them. There also, as discussed in For the Record 330, is an interesting link between the Oklahoma City bombing and the AMIA bombing in Argentina. It has been alleged that members of the specifically in the Argentine press, members of the cell that within Argentine security forces that aided the AMIA bombing in 1994 were connected to White Aryan Resistance, and that's an organization which certainly had links to Dennis Mahone, an associate of Strassmeyer and McVeigh, and to which McVeigh also was allegedly connected. But one of the things that to note in terms of aiding sort of Nazi an underground Reich popular political methodology when a reflexive cover-up of any kind takes place, and it would certainly appear that this took place vis-a-vis the FBI, that feeds rumor-mongering. So excessive government secrecy and cover-ups of any kind tend to leave it wide open for irresponsible or outright subversive elements to move into the gap that is left by the disinformation. What we're going to be looking at for much of this program concerns areas of commonality between things that would appear to have, at least at first glance, to have no connection whatsoever, namely some of these street-level anti-government operatives such as Timothy McVeigh and others, some of the Islamo-fascists linked to the Al-Taqwa milieu and Al-Qaeda and the architects of September 11th, and the Bush administration. And we're going to be looking at this in a context that is considerably different from what other people may have been presenting. I'm not advancing the hypothesis here that September 11th was an agent provocateur operation to justify martial law or the restriction of civil liberties. It certainly has been used in an opportunistic way by the Bush administration to do just that. But rather, I would compare September 11th to the German invasion of France in World War II. That was not a provocation, yet it was used by German-affiliated elements of the power elite in France to basically do what they wanted to do, which is to help install fascism in France, and the links between powerful French industrialists and financiers and the German industrialists and financiers who were left in control of the French corporate establishment at the end of World War II is one of the power blocks that we're looking at in the geopolitical struggle that is taking place vis-a-vis Iraq. And looking beyond the immediate ideological divide. I think one can clearly see a geopolitical struggle between that Franco-German corporate axis and their American counterparts for control of what the Nazi geopoliticians called the Earth Island. But we're going to be looking at things in a somewhat different perspective in this broadcast than people are accustomed to experiencing. That, I think, characteristic of the For the Record series as a whole. Now, we're going to take a look at The Turner Diaries, again, one of the books put out by National Vanguard Books and authored by one Andrew McDonald, actually a note of plume for William Pierce, the late head of the National Alliance. Now, bear in mind that William Pierce was very explicit about using the novels that he publishes as teaching tools, and we're going to review a section that we concluded the last broadcast with. This is from the Turner Diaries republished edition by Barricade Books. The ISBN number is 80-82692, and this is an edition that was put out in 1996 by Barricade Books. But again, this is the same book that was originally published by National Vanguard Books. Now, as we contemplate the Turner Diaries, which was the inspiration for Timothy McVeigh and company, and for the Nazi terror group The Order in the mid-1990s, the group that murdered Alan Berg, the Denver talk show host, I think that it does not require a great leap of faith to see a very strong possibility that the inspiration for the attack on the Pentagon, for the methodology for the attack on the Pentagon on September 11th, may very well have come from the Turner Diaries. Now, again, this is not a precise foreshadowing of the scenario, but I think it's close enough that it is not unreasonable to view the possibility that this was the seed that was planted for the September 11th attack on the Pentagon. From the Turner Diaries, we read, and by the way, the first person singular is Earl Turner, the fictional author of these diaries, and this is actually the conclusion, the climactic event in the Turner Diaries, and it is basically a suicide aerial attack by low-flying aircraft on the Pentagon. But the I here is Earl Turner, the author of the Turner Diaries. I conferred privately with Major Williams of Washington Field Command for more than an hour on the problem of attacking the Pentagon. The military's other major command centers were either knocked out on September 8th or subsequently consolidated with the Pentagon, which the top brass apparently regard as impregnable. And it damn near is. We went over every possibility we could think of, and we came up with no really convincing plan except perhaps one. That is to make an air delivery of a bomb. In the massive ring of defenses around the Pentagon, there's a great deal of anti-aircraft firepower, but we decided that a small plane flying just above the ground might be able to get through the 3-mile gauntlet with one of our 60-kiloton warheads. One factor in favor of such an attempt is that we have never before used aircraft in such a way, and we might hope to catch the anti-aircraft crews off their guard. Although the military is guarding all civil airfields, it just happens that we have an old crop duster stashed in a barn only a few miles from here. My immediate assignment is to prepare a detailed plan for an aerial attack on the Pentagon by next Monday. We must make a final decision at that time and then act without further delay. And then the next chapter begins after the plan has been developed. By the way, I would note a couple of things in the first place, although, again, this is not a direct foreshadowing, a precise foreshadowing, I should say, of the September 11th attack on the Pentagon. It's pretty close, as I say, close enough for jazz. I would note that there are a number of credible accounts that the September 11th pilots were trying to get a hold of a crop dusting plane, supposedly to distribute chemical or biological weapons, but who knows, perhaps they had in mind something like this here, or a variant. Chapter 28 of the Turner Diaries begins with this notation from November 9th of 1993. It's still 3 hours until first light, and all systems are go. I'll use the time to write a few pages, my last diary entry. Then it's a one-way trip to the Pentagon for me. The warhead is strapped into the front seat of the old Stearman and rigged to detonate either on impact or when I flip a switch in the back seat. Hopefully, I'll be able to manage a low-level airburst directly over the center of the Pentagon. Failing that, I'll at least try to fly as close as I can before I'm shot down. It's been more than 4 years since I've flown, but I've thoroughly familiarized myself with the Stearman cockpit and been briefed on the plane's peculiarities. I don't anticipate any piloting problems. The barn hangar here is only 8 miles from the Pentagon. We'll thoroughly warm the engine up in the barn, and when the door is opened, I'll go like a bat out of hell straight for the Pentagon at an altitude of about 50 feet. And again, though not a precise foreshadowing of the September 11th attacks, it is quite close. Basically, a low-level aircraft suicide attack on the Pentagon, in this case involving nuclear weapons. That obviously was not the case on September 11th. But I do think that, the similarity is close enough there that when one sees a possible link such as the LA Weekly article, which I will re-annotate for you later in the program. That, by the way, is reproduced almost completely in the written description for the Record 373. You can listen to it streaming on WFMU. I would note that when one sees links between, alleged links between Saddam Hussein and Timothy McVeigh, and alleged links between the Oklahoma City bombing in September 11th, as well as between the first World Trade Center attack in September 11th, these are not things to be dismissed, but rather to be seen in the context of the underground Reich and the virtual state that is the underground Reich. And that is a virtual state that has links to many diverse elements, many of them not even conscious of the fact that some of their number are in bed with the underground Reich and therefore affiliated with their enemies. The title of this book, The Serpent's Diaries, refers to the fact that it refers to the fact that in Serpent's Walk and in the Turner Diaries, both of which are fictional works about a Nazi takeover of the United States but intended as teaching tools, the conditions that permit the Nazi takeover of the United States and the overthrow of the supposed Zionist control of the United States, the conditions are widespread devastation produced by terrorist attacks with weapons of mass destruction. Now, in the book Serpent's Walk, those weapons of mass destruction are biologically engineered microorganisms which destroy much of the U.S. and much of the rest of the world. And in the Turner Diaries, they are nuclear weapons that are used by the Order, the Nazi group that is described in the Turner Diaries, to wipe out sections of the United States and seize control from the, quote, Zionist occupation government. But in examining, now for the time being, the links that Islamofascists might have with, or the common interests, I should say, that help to link elements of the Islamofascist movement with elements of the international Nazi and white supremacist movement, in addition, obviously, to anti-Semitism, and we're going to come to the whole issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how that is being manipulated, but the desire to destroy the United States, and in this context, one should view the white supremacists and the Islamofascists as proxy warriors for a Third Reich gone underground. And instead of harnessing a nuclear bomb flown by the America bomber, which the Nazis were designing to fly across the Atlantic and drop a bomb on New York, instead elements of the Third Reich's nuclear capability, and they had a fledgling nuclear program, helped to give Saddam Hussein software for the mass production of nuclear weapons. We talked about that in For the Record 395. And I would note that German elements also helped to give Pakistanis key nuclear technology that was financed in part through the BCCI, and Saudi Arabia helped to finance Saddam Hussein's acquisition of nuclear software from Degussa. But destroying Israel, wiping out the Jews, and destroying the United States is one of the things that links the seemingly disparate elements such as Timothy McVeigh and others inspired by the Turner Diaries with Islamofascists. But the conditions under which an underground Reich takeover of the United States takes place are basically very similar in Serpent's Walk and the Turner Diaries. After terrorist incidents with weapons of mass destruction, which not only wipe out much of the country, including, by the way, the areas that were won by Al Gore in 2000, the eastern urban centers and California, the terrorist attacks with the weapons of mass destruction devastate much of the United States, kill much of its population, and terminally weaken the central authority, then in the context of this terrorist-destroyed United States, then the Nazis take over. So that when one looks, for example, for motivation for Islamofascists and white supremacists hooking up, the end goals of the Turner Diaries and Serpent's Walk would be realized by the attacks that were being planned, on the one hand by Timothy McVeigh and company, and on the other by the apparently linked elements from the September 11th Al-Qaeda milieu, and quite possibly from underground Reich elements associated with Saddam Hussein. We're going to read a short section of the Turner Diaries, followed by a short section of Serpent's Walk. And again, just imagine that this is what in fact they are, teaching tools for the underground Reich milieu. From the Turner Diaries, we read this description of what things are like as the order begins to take over. Last and perhaps not least, everyone in the enclave is indisputably white. We dealt summarily with every questionable case, by the way, that means execution, while outside it is the usual god-awful assortment of whites, mostly whites, half-whites, gypsies, Chicanos, Puerto Ricans, Jews, blacks, Orientals, Arabs, Persians, and everything else under the sun. The typical cosmopolitan racial goulash one finds in every American metropolitan area these days. Anyone who feels a need for a little brotherhood, unquote, Jewish style, can leave our enclave, but I doubt that many will feel the need. November 2nd. We had a long meeting this afternoon at which we were briefed on the latest national developments and given new priorities for our local action program. There has been remarkably little change in the national situation during the past 6 weeks. The government has been able to do very little to restore order in the devastated areas or to compensate for the damage done to the nation's transportation network, its power generating and distribution facilities, and the other essential components of the national economy. The people are being left on their own to a very large extent while the system grapples with its own problems, not the least of which is renewed uncertainty over the reliability of its military forces. That lack of change is in itself very encouraging because it means that the system is not recovering the degree of control over the country which it exercised prior to September 8th. That was a date on which the order launched widespread terrorist attacks. The government has simply not been able to cope with the chaotic conditions which now prevail throughout wide areas. Our units have been doing everything they can in the way of sabotage, of course, just for the purpose of keeping things destabilized. But Revolutionary Command has apparently been waiting to see what sort of intermediate-term situation would gel before deciding the next phase of the organization's strategy. And on the at the beginning of the next side of the program, we're going to take a look at a very similar situation which is posited in Serpent's Walk. Again, after attacks by weapons of mass destruction, wiping out much of the population, including the large metropolitan centers, the Nazi faithful take over. I've alluded to other programs. Those are available from a tape and CD duplication service called Spitfire. Their address is P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And you can visit the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. And in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there'll be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of this program within a week or so of its broadcast. I would also note that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. Almost the entire series is now available. Recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only on a longer URL, linked both to the first WFMU address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Spitfire, by the way, will provide CDs and or tapes free to any station that wishes to broadcast For the Record. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 399, The Serpent's Diaries, being recorded on November, on Freudian slip, on February 16th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.